Hi, welcome to this Physicians Weekly's podcast. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm your host for this podcast, and today we've got some great interviews as usual.
This is Physicians Weekly.
Welcome to Podcast 97. The 14th century bubonic plague pandemic was caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis, and it killed up to half the population in Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa. It's been hypothesized that such a deadly disease may have provided a selection event for genetic variants that protect against infection. People with protective versions of certain genes could be more likely to survive and then pass on those variants to future generations. Yet pinpointing such variants has always been a challenge. So today we're going to talk about an NIH-funded team of researchers, which was led by Hendrik Poinar at McMaster University in Canada and Louise Barrero at the University of Chicago, Illinois, and they sampled DNA from the remains of more than 500 people who died before, during, and after the Black Death. We talked with Dr. Barrero about how they found that genetic variants that were enriched by the Black Death actually contribute to Crohn's disease and other autoimmune disorders. This was a really super interesting story. In our second interview, we zoom in on one of the presentations that was held just last week at the American Society of Clinical Oncology, ASCO. Their annual meeting was held from the 2nd to the 6th of June, 2023 in Chicago. There have been some big breakthroughs in the treatment of liver cancer the last 2 years, and one of the questions that we've been asking is whether non-trial populations of patients do as well as those reported in the major clinical trials. We speak today with Dr. Chalin Li from the Princess Margaret Cancer Center at the University of Toronto in Canada about therapy with atezolizumab and bevacizumab, improving recurrence-free survival in patients with hepatocellular carcinoma, or HCC, following surgical resection or ablation, according to the results from the Phase 3 IMbrave 50 clinical trial. As this combination therapy is now finding its way into practice, Dr. Chalin Li performed this study to assess the efficacy, safety, and value of esophagogastroduodenoscopy, or EGD, with regard to the combination therapy in the real-world setting. Enjoy listening. Great. So thank you so much for joining us. So why don't we just start by telling us who you are and what you do? What's your research line?
Yes, so my name is Luis Barreiro. I'm a professor in human genetics at the University of Chicago. And my lab basically is interested in understanding the contribution of natural selection to the evolution of the immune system, and most specifically, the impact that pathogens had in human evolution. So we are very interested in understanding how individuals from, for example, different genetic ancestries might respond differently to pathogens today as a function of past selective events. So that's kind of general interest of the lab, is really trying to understand the contribution of natural selection to the evolution of our species.
And your lab had a paper a few months ago in Nature looking at a story that began in the mid-1300s. Could you tell us a little bit about that? What was that story?
Yes. So like I said, so we are very interested in understanding the impact that pathogens had in our evolution. And when we think about pandemics in the past that have had an important impact in mortality, the Black Death was probably the single greatest mortality event in record history, having killed anywhere from 30 to 50% of the population in Europe in less than 5 years. So given how, you know, the high mortality rates, we hypothesized that maybe the individuals that survived the pandemic were not necessarily just a random set of the population, but might have been individuals that harbored particular genetic variants that would have been protective during the Black Death. So that was, you know, the original motivation, try to understand if that one specific event might have had an important role in selecting for particular genetic variants in the genome.
Right. So how'd you go about doing it? I suppose you identified graves that had verified victims of the Black Death?
So that's right. Yeah. So this was work that we did in collaboration with Hendrik Poinar at the University of McMaster, and he's really an expert in ancient DNA. So all the ancient DNA aspect of the work was primarily done in his lab. And so they had access to remains from individuals, so over 300 skeletons from individuals that lived either before the Black Death individuals that died from the Black Death and people that lived a few generations afterwards. So just by having access to those specimens, we were able to extract DNA from those 300 plus individuals and then just sequence particular regions of the genome that we're interested in. In this particular case, we focused on genes involved in immune responses and just asked a simple question as whether or not we had evidence that particular genetic variants had changed in allele frequency more than expected by chance when we compare individuals that lived before the Black Death and those that live after the Black Death, which of course are the descendants of those that survived the pandemic.
You came up with a bunch of information, a bunch of data. How did you sort through it and figure out which variants might be relevant here and which not? And I suppose because the hypothesis was a selection event, that there'd be selective pressure, do you have special modeling techniques to examine that pattern?
So here we are looking for a very specific pattern that was, so the hypothesis was if there's a particular genetic variant that was, that will, for example, protect you against the Black Death, the expectation was that we will expect that variant to increase in allele frequency when we compare individuals that lived before against those that lived after the Black Death. So there's a very specific expectation about the direction of those changes in allele frequency. And in addition, if that's indeed the variant that was implicated in susceptibility to the Black Death, the other expectation is that that variant should be found at lower allele frequencies in those that died from the Black Death. So basically, we were looking for those very specific features in the data. And that's how we somehow prioritize particular genetic variants. And it's actually important to keep in mind the fact that though it's probably one of the largest studies in terms of sample size for an ancient DNA study at any given moment in historical time, right? So it remains a relatively small sample size as compared to the type of genome-wide association studies that are done today in modern populations where we have thousands and thousands of individuals. So that remains an obvious limitation here.
And did you employ some of that information of our modern day European cohort to compare it with? Because you'd want to, I guess, see that those are enriched, those allele frequencies.
Yeah, so we also, as part of the characterization of the fluctuations in allele frequency, we also include the frequency of the alleles in present in populations in Brittany, yes. Yeah. So what we are seeing is that for the vast majority, those alleles that we have found to show evidence of having been protective during the Black Death, the allele frequencies after the Black Death tend to be more similar to those that we observe today as compared to the frequencies that we observe pre-Black Death.
Okay, so what did you find? What were the alleles that protected against the Black Death?
So our strongest hit was in a gene called ERAP2, so that's an aminopeptidase. And that gene, what it does is to chop peptides, so cut proteins in small peptides, for them to be presented to T cells by MHC class 1. And what was interesting is that the variant that we found to have been protective is a variant for which we actually have quite good knowledge about what it does. So in this particular case, in the population, there's two possible variants for that gene. One that creates a premature stop codon, which basically means that there are individuals in the population, they don't have a functional version of the gene. And so you can think about it in simple terms that there's individuals that have this ERAP2 that is functional, other individuals that don't have a functional version of it. And what we found is that having functional version of ERAP2 appeared to have been protective during the Black Death.
Okay, and so that meant that probably it primed the immune system better to recognize the Black Death at an earlier stage and then gave you a slight advantage to survive it by early immune response.
So that's one of the hypotheses, that by allowing to basically chop peptides to be presented to the immune system, it allows for a faster recognition of the pathogen. So that's one hypothesis. But the other thing that we have seen also is that if we infect, so we did this experiment, and that's part of what we report in the papers, that if you infect macrophages, which are innate immune cells that are the first to encounter the pathogen and to eat the bacteria, we saw that macrophages derived from individuals that have that protective allele, they are better at killing Yersinia pestis, so the agent that causes the Black Death, as compared to macrophages derived from individuals that don't have the allele. So it appears that there's also a direct impact on the function of these innate immune cells beyond just the ability of these cells to present antigens to the adaptive immune system.
Right. And so you mentioned at the beginning that your lab is interested in the evolution of the immune system.
Correct.
What did you learn from this particular experiment, understanding the event that occurred around the Black Death?
So I think probably the most exciting aspect of it was to realize that even in humans, it is possible to detect events of selection in a very, very short period of time, and as a result of a single pandemic event. So that suggests that throughout our evolution, we probably have had many events of selection that occurred in response to very different pathogens, and that, you know, if we were able to just look at selection temporally over time, probably we'll be able to identify many of those selective events in a way that we might not be able to do if we just look at modeling populations. So I think the ability to identify selection acting almost in real time in just, you know, 5 years or so.
Can you say that this is just a uniquely European event as well, or is this true across other ethnic backgrounds?
So, I mean, I cannot speak to that question because we have only looked at these patterns of selection in European populations. So our two cohorts was one from London and another one from the Denmark. So I don't think I can extrapolate to other populations regarding cystic fibrosis and cholera. So I guess those are examples of trade-offs. The same applies, for example, for sickle cell and malaria, right? And in that sense, there's some similarities here because, interestingly, what we saw is that this variant appears to have been protective during the Black Death, it's the same genetic variant that today actually increases the risk for Crohn's disease and maybe even diabetes. So there seems to be some sort of a trade-off between something that was protective against infectious agents, but at the same time today increases the risk for autoimmune disorders, correct?
No, I understand that entirely. So that's really interesting. So it's the Goldilocks theory. You have to have just the right amount. What are the next steps?
So in this line of research, we are now trying to expand sample sizes and trying to also look more globally at the entire genome rather than just focusing on these immune genes that we studied. So that's, you know, the next obvious step. And then, more generally in terms of my lab interests, we are definitely trying to expand to characterize these events of selection across different populations around the globe rather than just focusing on, say, European ancestry individuals. So that's, you know, a very important focus of the lab is really try to characterize patterns of genetic diversity and functional diversity in the immune system in a representative manner by studying as many populations around the globe as we can.
That's fantastic. Okay, thank you so much.
Sure.
The next speaker is Dr. Chalin Lee from the University of Toronto, and she's going to talk about the role of EGD in the treatment of hepatocellular carcinoma, specifically with the treatment with the atezolizumab and bevacizumab, which may logically increase bleeding. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Lee. So I did want to really know about your research. Can you tell me about the unmet need and why it's important that we have real-world data on atezolizumab and bevacizumab?
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to thank you for the kind invitation and opportunity to talk to you today. So hepatocellular carcinoma is a significant global health concern, currently ranking the fourth leading cause of cancer-related death worldwide. So since 2008, there has been a huge surge in development of novel treatment targeting this disease, particularly in the area of immunotherapy. So when IMbrave 150 trial showed the superiority of atezolizumab with bevacizumab in terms of overall survival, progression-free survival, and response rate against the sorafenib, this combination treatment was recognized as the first-line treatment option for HCC since 2020. And the IMbrave 150 trial also reported that the treatment-related gastric intestinal bleeding was 7% compared to 4.5% in the sorafenib group. So as the result, the trial recommended that, you know, all the patients should have endoscopic EGD within 6 months prior to the treatment in order to identify any varices which may increase the likelihood of bleeding when undergoing this treatment. So now that considering 3 years have passed and it's evident that this treatment has significantly impacted the landscape of HCC, However, you know, the value of performing, you know, pre-treatment EGD in all the patients remaining uncertain. Besides the efficacy and the bleeding risk of atezolizumab with bevacizumab in the real-world setting are still unclear. So with all that question, we decided to perform a retrospective analysis on this topic.
Okay, very interesting. And can you tell me a little bit about what your methodologies were that you used and what the results were?
So in Canada, we have a HCC Cancer Health Outcome Research Database. It's like a consortium that's already existing nationally across 10 cancer centers in different provinces. So for this specific retrospective, we managed to include collaborators from 5 cancer centers, which is in the provinces of Ontario, Alberta, and Manitoba. So that's how we managed to get all those retrospective data for this project.
Excellent. And so what were the results that you saw?
So for this result, we were focusing more on the efficacy and the safety and the uptake of the EGD. So in total, we managed to recruit 112 patients who has been treated from 1st of July 2020 to 31st August 2022. So overall, our patient baseline characteristics were similar to those enrolled in the IMbrave 150 trial. Although we do treat more, you know, BCLC stage B patients and those who previously who has underwent local therapy in comparison to those who has been reported in the IMbrave 150 trial. The other thing that I want to mention is all our patients receive atezolizumab with bevacizumab outside clinical trial setting. And 90% of them receive the treatment as first line, and 9% of it receive as second line, and we do have 1% who receive as third line. So yeah, because some of the patient was paying it out of their private insurance. So that was within our study populations. So in terms of efficacy, after a median follow-up of 10.4 months, our reported overall survival for our study population was 20.3 months, and the median progression-free survival was 9.6 months. And for this study population, our disease control rate achieved with the treatment was 76.8 months. So altogether, if you put all those numbers, it is quite comparable to that was reported in the IMbrave 150 trial.
Well, that's great news for the real-world population, yes. Right? Because oftentimes we see somewhat more complex results when you take it out of the study. Okay, excellent. And so what are some of the conclusions you can draw from this data, and what are the implications for practice?
Absolutely. So in total, we recruited 112 patients who were treated from 1st of July 2020 to 31st of August 2022. Overall, our patient baseline characteristic was similar to those enrolled in the IMbrave 150 trial. Although we do treat more BCLC stage B patients and those who has previously underwent local therapy for their HCC. All our patients receive atezolizumab with bevacizumab outside clinical trial setting, and 90% of them receive this treatment as first line, and 9% of them receive a second line, while 1% receive it as third line. So in terms of efficacy, after a median follow-up of 10.4 months, the median overall survival for the whole population was 20.3 months, and median progression-free survival was 9.6 months. And the disease control rate achieved with atezolizumab with bevacizumab for our study population was 76.8%. So altogether, the value that I have told you there was comparable as reported to the IMbrave 150 trial. So this is quite reassuring, you know, because we were trying to find out about the real-world efficacy of this treatment in comparison to the trial setting. While the second part of the study, which is related to the EGD uptake and bleeding complication related to the treatment, we discovered that 70% of the patient completed EGD within 6 months before starting treatment, while the other 13% proceeded with the treatment without any EGD as per their local clinician, without any invasive determinations of the portal hypertension or compensated advanced chronic liver disease. And for those who has undergone EGD, 41% do have evidence of varices seen on their endoscopic investigations, and 20% of those do require treatment with either ligation or beta blockers. And those numbers that I have just told you there was twice the rate reported in the IMbrave 150 trial. And that actually are not surprising because it is reflecting the real-world high-risk population that we are treating in this study.
Very clear. So what are some of the implications for this, especially with regard to the bleeding? Should we be careful and cautious when we give atezolizumab and bevacizumab to our HCC patients? Or is this something that we can just now note and realize that there's a slight difference in the trial data versus the real-world evidence?
Yeah. Overall, the treatment-related bleeding rate observed in this study is 15%. And the rate of bleeding, if you break it down between EGD groups and non-EGD group, the EGD group is actually 18%, which is higher compared to the non-EGD group, which is 9%. Again, this is not surprisingly. If you think about it, the EGD group is probably higher risk. Therefore, they were sent by the doctor to have some investigation before they get their treatment. However, you know, when we further, you know, analyze the data, 10% of the bleeding complications are actually non-GI bleeding. You know, they are kind of like, you know, epithesis, bruises, and gum bleeding, while the other 5% are actually specific GI bleeding. And when we actually analyze all the patients who have GI bleeding against non-GI bleeding, there wasn't any meaningful overall survival or PFS differences between the two patient group.
Yes. Okay. Very good words. And what are the next steps to go further with this research? Do you have any plans to continue or expand the cohort?
Definitely is still a very small study, and I can't make any firm conclusion based on that. However, our study do show potential for selective EGD in patients with low risk of hepatic decompensation. And our study do show that the approach of selective EGD is feasible in certain patients based on their characteristic and risk factor in order for the patient to start treatment sooner without waiting for EGD, and that also have a potential for clinical cost saving. But until we find out more about this, I think, you know, we do have to kind of lean on the cautious side to, you know, investigate our patient with pre-treatment EGD before they go on atezolizumab with bevacizumab, as it does involve a high dose of bevacizumab. Yeah, so at the moment, the sample is definitely small, and but we are excited about it. So we are in the process of publishing it to get the data out there, because we do need to have real-world data in regards to this atezolizumab with bevacizumab in terms of efficacy and safety. So it does have some value in getting it published. But meanwhile, like you say, we do want to continue to expand on the sample size of this retrospective analysis with more collaborators from our other Canadian Cancer Center. But in the long-term plan, we are actually considering a prospective study with our multidisciplinary team, including hepatologists, for a better guideline to stratify our HCC population around the area of variceal bleeding related to cirrhosis and atezolizumab with bevacizumab. And it is actually just getting started, so I'm actually quite excited to see where it will take me too, and also our team too. So I do really want to thank my supervisor, Professor Jennifer Knox in PMH, and also co-supervisor Dr. Vincent Tan at Tom Becker Cancer Center, and all the collaborators, data managers, and patients for their support in this project. Without them, this is definitely will not be possible.
Okay, those are wise words to end with. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for listening to Physicians Weekly. Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.